Welcome to Pondering Popper. My name is Jacob, also known as Calikais, also known as Satan Raken on Magic Online. Today I'm bringing you a podcast, and I'm bringing on one of the members of the Popper Format panel, Alex Ullman. He's been in Popper for a very long time, does a lot of data analysis, likes to tweak kind of off-meta decks, and I'm really happy to introduce him. Welcome.
Hey, happy to be here.
Before we get going, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? What are you up to nowadays? How did you get started in Magic? You know, your whole shebang.
Oh, yeah, everything. So, yeah, my name's Alex Ullman. For those of you who don't know me, I'm nerd to the core on Twitter and in a bunch of other places. I've been a content creator for Magic and specifically Pauper going back about 13, 14 years at this point, getting started on puremtgo.com before moving over to Star City Games and then Gathering Magic, now Cool Stuff, Inc. And then I got picked up by Channel Fireball, which is now part of the Channel Fireball TCG player conglomerate, I guess.
Wow.
Along the way, I got roped into, you know, doing Wizards and then Channel Fireball event coverage for Grand Prix. Remember Grand Prix?
Mm-hmm.
And Magic Fests. But, you know, what, you know, at this point, I'm, 38 years old. I got started in Magic like a lot of people my age who play, you know, on the schoolyard. I don't remember what. I remember seeing these cards, and it was right around Fallen Empires and Ice Age. So those were the packs I got.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have one of those stories where I traded like a Rock Hydra for a Sea Serpent. I had like original Duel Lands that from Revised that are nowhere to be found these days. But, you know, a lot of people take breaks from Magic. My break was, I think, 1996. And then when I went to junior high school in, for those who don't know, I grew up in New York City, still live in Brooklyn, and would get The Duelist, which is this, you know, old magazine. And there was an ad in the back of one for a game store in New York, which wasn't far from where I went to junior high school. It was called Neutral Ground. And I went there and played in a Mirage Sealed Deck tournament against, I think I played against a Hall of Famer, an O'Mahony Schwartz brother, and then I played against the other O'Mahony Schwartz brother, who are longtime Magic pros, and just kept going back. Really, until I went to grad school, I would spend a lot of Friday nights there playing Friday Night Magic. I would PTQ there without even knowing what a PTQ really was. Just wanted a chance to play Standard or Extended or whatever. You know, became friendly with the shop owner, who is Brian David Marshall, someone I still talk to a lot these days. And when I got to college, I was a kid on a budget. Magic Online had kind of just come out, and I was looking for ways to, you know, feed that competitive streak while also being a kid on a budget. You know, I had a part-time job at college, so I used a little bit of that money to, you know, do a couple drafts, do a couple sealed events, built a lot of casual decks. But then it was my junior year of college, so that's 2005. And there's an article on the mothership about this community on Magic Online called PDC, or Pauper Deck Challenge, which was a player-run community of people who played with exclusively commons. They did player-run events.
Wow. So you started basically right after Pauper started in existence. You started joining the Pauper community?
Let's see. I got involved in the Pauper community in PDC before. So back in the day, they ran like, I want to say it was 4 month seasons. And I got into it after the end of season two.
Wow.
So I got involved at the start of season three. I remember very specifically, I was bringing not, you know, I was never a great Magic player. I was an okay one. I would routinely end up like 5-3 at an 8-round PTQ in New York City, which is, you know,
that's pretty respectable at that point.
I would hope so. You know, if I had been better at Magic and had made more judge calls, I probably would have been able to like get to 6-2 and miss top 8 on breakers but I brought like a more competitive mindset, you know, and this was not competitive, but it was very much, you know, at one point, one of the very prominent players was playing a card called Spy Network, which let you look at your opponent's hand, look at the top 5 cards of your library, and do some general bad blue card, 1-mana sorcery stuff, and was like, this card should be banned. I'm like, this card should not be banned. And I built a low to the ground red deck full of haste creatures and cards like Sparksmith. And, you know, this was before Lightning Bolt or Incinerate was on Magic Online. So
wow.
it was a long time ago. And so won that event, and that deck kind of defined the metagame for the rest of that season. And I was hooked. I won that event. There was every 4 weeks they ran, a casual tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of them was Rainbow Stairwell, which is it was a 60 card deck, and you have to build, you know, you have one slot from each mana cost and one for each color. And I broke the format by playing a Morph. I played Morph and won that tournament.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, no, I'm just going to play all the Morph creatures and cycling creatures. I'm like, oh, wow, that worked. And that was in 2005. So I was really involved in the format since before there were tournament, like before there was official sanctioning. And then, you know, we were really one of the more popular player-run communities online. So after a while, we were able to advocate the MTGO team to give us a real filter.
Right.
Because this was back in the day where there was casual format 1, which was 5 color.
Yeah.
And casual format 2, which was Singleton or Highlander. And then there was casual format 3, which became Tribal Wars. And then there was Pauper. And we were really one of the real success stories of the player-run community on Magic Online. And, you know, that's kind of how Pauper was until, I want to say like 2008, 2009, which is when they started doing major tournaments.
Really?
On Magic Online. I think so. I mean,
I don't have any history with playing Pauper since pre-2017. I think I started after Drake when it was mostly Tron and just before Blue Black Delver was a big thing. I actually played Magic Online starting in 2000 or 2001.
The open beta.
I think I wasn't in the beta. I may have been in the beta, but I was definitely in the side beta where they did the testing and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I played a lot of limited, and it was like Odyssey and Onslaught Block when I started.
Yeah, I remember very fondly my first year, or it might have been my second year in college, is when they were really doing a significant rebuild, and they were just running, you know, draft after draft that you could join for free. And I joined so many triple Onslaught Rockchester drafts that I had to leave after the draft because I was running late to class. but yeah, Pauper was really, and it was so popular in part because people just ran events. There was like a Saturday morning event, a Saturday evening event. There were Tuesday events. People started doing, you know, standard Pauper. And that for a while, you know, was a really interesting format that, funny enough, was dominated by Guardian of the Guild Pact. Shocker, good creature a million years ago and still good today.
Yeah.
But when they started doing format challenges, which were different than the challenges today, these were like not regularly scheduled. I remember starting to get, you know, getting some, I still have the results buried somewhere in my Google Drive of just the number of events. And it was, you know, there were some people, you know, someone who definitely played a lot back then who's still active today. M. Lovebo, or back then when he went by the .ZZZ.
Oh, wow. I remember seeing that name a long time ago, the .ZZZ.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it's the same person.
Pretty sure they are. And so, yeah, but this is already, you know, 2008, 2009 is 13 years ago at this point. I started, you know, I submitted my first article to Star City Games in 2006. And that's back when they took open submissions. And what started me in content was I was doing a lot of forum posts and a lot of writing for, you know, Pauper websites. And I was like, oh, there's this website where I can write for store credit. And it was puremtgo.com. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, you know, I'll do this in grad school. I got nothing else to do. I was up in Buffalo, New York, and I didn't have a lot of friends up there. There wasn't a local game store I could get to easily back then. So I was, you know, playing a lot of Pauper, doing a lot of thinking about Pauper, wrote a lot about bad decks and ideas, and, you know, eventually honed my craft and, you know, parlayed into what sometimes astounds me as the writing career I've developed with Pauper.
Has it been something that's been mostly just for fun and for having the ability to just put your thoughts out there, and you're enjoying continuing to do that? Or is it something that's been, you know, like a side job for you?
Like, it's tough to kind of talk about that, because I wouldn't do this if I didn't really enjoy it, you know?
Right.
So you have
this passion that you've been in Pauper since the very, very beginning, and you love talking about it. You love thinking about it. I think a lot of people do. You're putting those thoughts into words and trying to get information out to people that might not have it. My friend from high school that got me into Magic in, I think, 2005 or 2004, he was like, hey, man, we should try writing for this Pure MTGO.
Yeah.
never really materialized for me.
I mean, I think what part of the content thing is that despite it being relatively popular, you know, there's still a lot of misconceptions about the format, both from inside out and outside in.
Correct, the number
of people who, like, will come to Pauper and be like, well, what do you mean this really overpowered common from three draft sets ago is unplayable? And like, well, you know,
it does cost 5.
Yeah. Or it costs 4, or it doesn't do anything. But then I think something that I've seen, you know, that I've always tried to combat is there are a lot of people who are hardcore Pauper players and don't play a lot of other formats.
Mm-hmm.
Who then think, like, well, the rules of Magic, like, some of the rules of Magic or the rules of engagement of Magic do not apply in this format. And I think that while that's true to some extent, I think there's a lot to be gained by looking at how Pauper differs from other formats, mm-hmm, as a way to understand both formats better. And I think, you know, a sneak peek of something I'm working on, I'm looking right now at, like, I think so many of the problems, or rather, not the problems, but the defining characteristics of Pauper today stem from 5-6 years ago when Planeswalkers were running roughshod over Standard and they started to make creatures better to combat Planeswalkers. And that's why we see so much stuff that plays to the board these days, and why so much stuff comes with material and just extra bonuses is to combat Planeswalkers. And so this huge limiting factor that would keep, you know, a creature like Jewel Thief, for example, or, you know, Sarwulf's Packmate, if you haven't figured out what kind of deck I've been playing recently, in check, just don't exist.
Right.
And so when you look at a format like Legacy or Modern, which are probably the closest analogs to Pauper in power level and play patterns, they have these wide sweeping effects or these huge high impact Planeswalkers. So a lot of the other things that would normally bubble up too much aren't as impactful. But, you know, what is it? Caves of Chaos Adventurer is seeing Legacy play in Red Prison decks. And there it's a high power card, but it's not outside of the realm of possibility or what should be expected in format like Legacy these days. Or that's the impression I get from some of the people I follow who play Legacy.
Right.
But then you see, you know, the Initiative in Pauper, and, you know, it was a mechanic I probably initially underrated.
I think we all did.
And then, but I think I underrated it because I did not realize how much Pauper had shifted from being a card accrual format to a card deploying format.
Right.
And I think that shift actually happened a couple of years ago, but we were all kind of caught off guard in a way, or I was, I should say, because the card accrual deck was Monarch, and it would just deploy its removal. But getting that stuff for free is huge.
Yeah, and they had the Monarch deck was mostly the Thorn deck you're talking about, right? Or because that was pre
Boros Monarch.
Oh, okay.
Like where it would just draw one mana removal spells every turn.
Right. So then the opponent could never get something on the board, and they would just have an infinite advantage that would just accrue over time. Basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
And now we're at the point where things are happening so quickly, you're not able to keep the board clear and depend on that free stuff. But in terms of having the low-cost initiative creatures coming into play so fast on turn one or turn two, and then the bonuses from the initiative were not going into your hand, they were going directly onto the battlefield or directly into play, so it was a little bit more powerful than we had imagined it to be. Even though things were small, they're happening for free and getting around the mana cost.
And that's kind of the big thing there, but regardless, I think that by looking at the wider Magic ecosystem and understanding how it influences Pauper can also help you think about different ways to look at the format. You know, one thing I love doing is looking at what cards overperform in their limited environments, like cards that really are just staple effects. And then when you cast them, like, oh, this is a little better than I anticipated. I think my favorite one from the latest set is Urborg Repossession, a black-green card. For anyone who knows me, that's not a huge shocker. But it's basically, you know, a Raise Dead plus and then two life, which doesn't seem like much, but when you think about it, it does so much for the format. It's cheap. It is a form of card advantage that you can then immediately deploy. And it's a little bit of a life buffer for, you know, the red decks that are running roughshod these days. So I think that Pauper players can benefit from looking at other formats and seeing what's going on there. But at the same way, I think that people outside of Pauper need to have a better understanding of how the format is different before jumping in. And I think that part of the issue is that, you know, you talked a little bit about monetary incentives before. The incentives to really do deep dives on Pauper are not there. It is not a regular PTQ format. It is, you know, the returns on doing well in Pauper are, you know, relatively slim.
Yeah, so I mean, really, on a high level, I think that people are making money in other countries, and people are making a lot of value from winning challenges and stuff like that. But it's not to the point where the people that were pro Magic players really need to care about it, because it's not going to earn them $500,000.
I mean, I think it's not even that. It's that it's a fun format. It is a surprisingly deep format for considering the card pool. But the big issue is that it is a small part of the competitive ecosystem.
Right.
And more than that is because it's such a small part, the incentives of gaining those edges are small.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens? What is the point? Why should people put energy into trying to find the hottest tech and then writing about it and sharing it out? And so what ends up happening is there's this small community, a small content community, and so it kind of has to stay within its bounds. And it's that, to me, that's the biggest struggle, is how to stay within the bounds and provide, you know, information for people who are regular players, but also provide information that's useful to everyone. And that's something that, you know, still working on.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out.
It's been really strange because, I mean, I guess I started playing Pauper and it was Tron, Boros, and Fairies. And then it transitioned into the Blue-Black Delver heyday with Foil. But still Tron is around and Tron was the big OP, big mana deck. And then we had all the blue cards got banned. And then from there it just felt like things... I talked about this before, but it felt like things started accelerating. Like we're just slammed on the gas and now we have Astrolabe, Sanctuary, Fall from Favor. Mm-hmm. And then we have a little bit of a reprieve going, but although we did have those big giant cascade creatures, which to me felt kind of like another big leap at the time. And then we went straight into Modern Horizons 2 with Affinity Storm. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, dealing with that fallout for so long, and we get waves and waves of bans, and then Storm goes away, Storm comes back, and then Affinity goes away, and then now we have all these things happening. It's just like, was I wrong? Did it get really powerful all of a sudden, or is it just that I didn't experience all the different power jumps that happened and got, you know, pushed back down? Was there? I know that when Pauper started, it was like it was a storm format. It was a format where things were happening on turn two, right? Things were happening very quickly.
Yeah. So the storm deck, once it got refined, was very powerful. And then there was Infect, and there was, you know, Frantic Search decks and all sorts of really, really powerful things. And I think what has happened is there's always been a lot of power packed into the cards. I think as the format has gotten larger and larger, and by that I mean more cards being printed into it, because let's also not forget ourselves, you know, we're not only talking about the regular cadence of standard legal sets, but now there's also Conspiracy and Battle Bond and the Horizons and the Master set. So Pauper, you know, it could get twice as many new cards that matter as every other format in a given year, especially when you look at downshifts.
Right.
Downshifts, you know, are something I hate discussing in a hypothetical, but it means that, you know, whenever there's a Modern Masters or an Eternal Masters or a Double Masters, those aren't printing new cards into other formats for the most part.
Right.
They're just printing new cards into Pauper sometimes.
And then, I mean...
No, go ahead.
What I was wondering was, it seems like the bans that occurred previously could be more directed and could flatten the power level with small changes. But now it looks like the power level has increased drastically on a wide enough amount of cards. Like it's it's raised across it, instead of just one thing poking out of the water, destroying everybody. And now there's not, if you were to say, hey, I want to go back to post Blue Monday, it's like, it's not doable anymore because there's too many things that are overpowered or comparatively overpowered, but it's not. And then again, we get to the point that Heisen said was that it's not overpowered if it's in balance.
Yeah, I think that, you know, he's a pretty smart guy, you know, I have to say. But I think what's kind of important to understand is for everything that has changed, Pauper still kind of hovers around that turn four, fundamental turn. And while in the past it might have been closer to five, and now it might be closer to three, it's still around four. But what has changed are the incentives, I guess would be a way to discuss it. If you want to talk about the incentives of, you know, the blue-black one drops deck, you know, that was very similar to the Tolarian Terror deck today, which is, you know, disrupt, churn through your library, free counter magic, gush, broken cards, cheap threats, go.
Right.
And the incentives there were to just churn. You know, the Monarch incentives are to play defense. And then there's the Tron incentives, which are to just leverage your overwhelming mana advantage to do two things a turn or more. The incentives used to change slowly.
Right.
And right now, we're probably in a two-year span where the incentives changed much more quickly across the board. I think a really interesting way to look at this is one of my favorite decks of all time, which is Mono Black Control. The original Mono Black Control was all Shivering Rats, Phyrexian Ragers, Gravediggers, up to Corrupt. And then it kind of fell off until Green Merchant. And then it became, it fits into a wider game plan because now you want to collect pips. So you can cast Gray Merchant after Gray Merchant, regrow Gray Merchant, and end the game.
Mm-hmm.
And that was okay for a little while. It was never great, but it was okay. And then came Thorn of the Black Rose, and it was like, okay, Mono Black Control now has another tool. And never going to be the best, still okay. Occasionally will spike a top 8, occasionally spikes a win, randomly enough. But still, you know, it's outdated. And now we have this completely different take on Mono Black Control. The incentives have changed. The incentives have changed from trying to develop a wide board to instead being, you know, Mono Black Control, if it had one creature, probably wasn't winning. Now, if it has one creature, it's probably doing the thing right because it has shifted from a board presence deck to a card accrual deck thanks to a card like Deadly Dispute. And I think a lot of the reasons that these incentives are changing so rapidly now is it's the weight of synergy. You know, when you have cheap artifacts, it doesn't really matter until you have something like a Deadly Dispute to really leverage it. And so now it becomes, all these cheap artifacts who, like, Navigator's Compass is not a good card, but when you can sacrifice it to Deadly Dispute, it becomes so much better.
Right.
You can sacrifice it to Makeshift Munitions, it becomes so much better. And with 30 years of cards, the weight of synergy is starting to really kind of push itself on the format. And that's why I think we've seen so much of this changing of incentives. But at the same point, Core Skyfisher and Galvanic Blast have been core to the format for years. Affinity has been core to the format for years. Maybe not as Grixis Control, but as other forms of a deck.
Right. It's definitely something that I was noticing too, is that there have always been these decks, but they've been more on what we used to say would be like a glass cannon side, especially with Affinity. Sure. Or even the Mono Red Blitz or Blue Red Blitz, where it was so much easier to just simply disrupt them and then you win the game. And now with Swift Spear in play and we have Synthesizer and Reckless Impulse, now we have this Sly deck that went from being like, okay, draw my 2/2, play my 2/2, to now I just drew 7 cards in a turn. And you're like, how did that happen? Yeah. And that's just continuing to be the case with all these things working together much better.
Yeah, I think Affinity is a weird case because if it were not for Gorilla Shaman, that deck would just be completely overpowered.
Right.
Like for most of Pauper's history. And even then, it was always a very, very good deck. But when you take away its one real weakness, then, it's not weak. The Red Blitz deck, I think, is also an interesting study because it's this weird tension of life gain is bad except when it's good. And when it's good, it's really good.
Right.
But if Blitz kills you on turn 2 or 3... it's hard to leverage your Weather the Storms or your Rest from the Weary. So I know Red did very well this weekend. I'm interested to see how it performs in the next couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested to see what happens when we get, you know, what's likely to be a lot more artifacts in a couple weeks. Hopefully not too many.
From the new set. Do you know when that's releasing?
I believe it releases at sometime in November. Well, let me see. If I remember correctly, League ends in about 2.5 or 3 weeks, so that means it's probably coming to Magic Online in 2.5 or 3 weeks.
So, hopefully that doesn't take over, but I guess we'll have to see how it goes. It's always interesting right now, trying to innovate and adapt. I guess this is something I was trying to say before, but I think that there's been all these things, and like you said, that existed in the format that we just didn't try to do because we didn't have to. With initiative in the battlefield on turn one and turn two, then people started playing Mogged. Mogged was the one who was playing this Kuldotha Rebirth goblin-heavy mono-red deck for a while, and that was like months and months and months ago. But now people started playing it again. I don't know if it was him that brought it back, but with Swift Spear, and now it just seems like that's a tier one deck now. Just all of a sudden, Burn is tier one, and it's got tons and tons of power. It can't be interacted with on a one-for-one basis anymore. So you, like you said, have to start adding things to the battlefield or doing many for ones in order to get past that deck. So I've had a lot of success playing against it by playing things like Prismatic Strands, things like Irishine Cleric or Dawnbringer Cleric, bringing them into the battlefield where you get many for ones again, and that is kind of a way to get past it. But it's hard to add... I think it's hard to see the change, and I don't think everyone in Pauper, or especially in Magic, is tweaking their decks to the level that some people do. And seeing these fluctuations is kind of wild. Like, the Modern Age, that's been a card for a long time as well. And it just was completely overshadowed because there was so many more better things to do.
The Modern Age is about as close to a Planeswalker as you can get in Pauper. You know, it's loot, get a flyer. Not great. But it does enough. It does enough moving pieces. It has enough synergy. You know, would the Modern Age be as good if you couldn't discard Sacred Cat or Deep Analysis or Prismatic Strands to it?
Right.
Probably not. Would it still see play? Maybe.
I just think people would be undervaluing it at that point. I even played an index without Strands and without Deep Analysis, and it ended up being pretty good. And I think it was LSV on one of the Limited Resources podcasts. The question was, when should I loot? And he said, always.
Yeah, that's actually, that is an old puzzle. And it's basically, your opponent is at like 5 life. You're playing Tempest Draft. And you have Merfolk Looter and Lightning Glass, which is 3 and a red, 4 mana, deal 4 damage to any target. And the question is, should you loot? And the answer is yes, because you might find a card that's better than Lightning Blast. And if it's not, you still have Lightning Blast. And I think PVDDR wrote a very, very long article that basically said you should loot like 99% of the time in the way that he writes. That was a really interesting moment in Magic strategy history, is the should you loot conversation.
Wow. I had no idea it was that involved. I just listened to the one-liner.
I have consumed a lot of Magic content over my 20-some-odd years of playing this game.
When did you start doing... were you doing meta-analysis basically right away when you were doing Pauper content?
So, back in the day, there really wasn't a metagame. You know... And, or rather not a metagame like we would see it today. Like, oh, everyone, PDC was taken care of on the old Magic forums that was run through Magic Online forums. And in order to claim prizes, you needed to publish your deck list. And a lot of this was done just to grow the format and be like, oh, here's a list, and this is how the list works, and it was great. I started doing metagame analysis back when there were daily events for Magic for Pauper, and daily events were tournaments that run several times a day, and they were 4 rounds. They were the precursor to leagues. It was the 4-0s and all the 3-1 deck lists. And the issue that would come up would be Cloud Post. Cloud Post was an utterly dominant deck at the time. you know, think Tron, but you have more spaces for color, discrete colors of mana. And you have more life gain because of Glimmer Post. And, well, if you got into a post mirror, it was whoever got to Rolling Thunder first. It was, you know, Tron before Tron. It was an absurdly powerful mana engine. And it was taking down 4-0s and 3-1s and just over and over. And I was collecting this data because I wanted to show the folks at Wizards of the Coast, like, hey, this is a problem. And, you know, eventually Cloud Post got banned. And that's kind of when I started doing more regular meta-analysis of tracking these. And then for a while there were, you know, when there was the huge Magic Online crash, they took away the daily events for Pauper and they brought back these 8-person queues, and I was tracking those results. And then when they brought back the challenges and we were getting more and more results, I would look at just the different results from daily events and then challenges. And now I still think, like, I only look at the top 32 of challenges because that's where I can, like, look at the deck lists and get all that information from really the source.
Right.
And not that I think that, like, I think the people who work on the challenge project are doing really, really amazing work. It's just not information that I choose to look at for what I do. I think, you know, information from that is really important and is probably underappreciated by the Magic community at large. But for me, it's, if I'm talking to people who might never have played Pauper before and might be looking to play in the challenge, like, are they going to care about the person who went 0-3 drop and what they played and what they played against? Probably not. They're going to care about, like, what's in the top 8, what's in the top 32, which deck in the top 32 might be well positioned for the next week, and which deck, even if it didn't make top 8, might have been a better performer than it's indicated. And so, you know, that's how I've been looking at the meta these days. It's like, well, what's the real story? And, you know, the real story tends to relatively line up with the eye test. What? Affinity does great. Blue-black does great. Red does great. Cogate does great. But the thing that I always think gets not overlooked but underappreciated is, like, well, what's going on under the surface? And I think part of the issue right now is, you know, looking at the results, there's not as much fluidity beyond that top tier. The top decks are so powerful, and that it's kind of completely redefining a lot of archetypes, because those decks I just talked about, and you can throw in Arbor Elf ramp decks into there as well, have kind of, like, completely changed the way the Pauper metagame functions from a year and a half ago.
Right.
Or 2 years ago. You know, you can look at a whole bunch of staple cards from 2020, 2019, and realize that they just do not have a home anymore. Like, when was the last time someone cast Chittering Rats with a straight face or Burning Tree Emissary with a straight face?
Right.
It has been a while.
Not in challenges. They still like to take it into leagues.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's an interesting thing, is that you have these decks that are highly synergistic and highly propped up. We have red propped up by all the exile card draw. We have Basilisk Gate. And the blue-black terror deck is really just the new version of the blue-black X-drops. And we have Affinity still hanging out and just doing really well. And it's very difficult for people to approach this with off-meta decks and have them be successful, especially without having a lot of failures. So people are just continuing to do the things that are having success, I guess. Or so what it seems like to me.
Yeah, I think with that question of, you know, if you're not losing, are you really learning anything? And I think that's really something someone much better at Magic than me told me a long time ago. And it actually reframed a lot of how I looked at building decks, doing stuff. I mean, when I build decks, I'm not always building completely off meta things. You know, the deck I've been talking about a lot these days is, it's an Arbor of Ramp deck. There are a lot of those running around. What's right. different about mine? I'm playing black instead of red. What else is different? Well, I'm running Moan of the Unhallowed because I'm a big believer in material mattering. But it took me a long time to get there. You know, I started with a green-white deck, and I thought that I really wanted to play Prismatic Strands, and it turns out you don't want to play Prismatic Strands in that deck because of Mirror Enforcer. Right. And also, Prismatic Strands is so popular that decks are now diversifying their threat base. They are running two-color threats. You know, you have Modern Age and Guardian of the Guild Pact. Well, I'm taking damage no matter what, so this isn't as good if I'm trying to protect the initiative. Mm-hmm. So white is worse in these decks. And black is somewhat better. You know, Arms of Hadar is probably one of the format-defining cards no one really talks about. Not that it's the world's best sweeper, but it gets around Strands.
Right.
And it gets around Basilisk Gate for the most part. And, you know, it, granted, you need to do some work, but I definitely had a turn where someone salt quit on me, where they had like two Guardians of the Guild Pact, and I cast Arms of Hadar and cast my second Arms of Hadar. And they did not really appreciate that very much.
Well, I got trounced by double Arms of Hadar as well. I played out all my familiars and all my O4s, thinking mm-hmm. I was super safe. And they just wiped everything and then played a Bajuka Bog. Oh no. Get you every time.
And so it's really about looking for, well, what is the metagame about this week? What am I seeing a lot of in the leagues? And how can I tweak? And I think you're right. People are taking decks and they're just playing decks, which is fine. It's a game. Not everyone wants to think about all this stuff all the time. Like, there are people who play a lot less Magic who just, you know what, I want to play the red deck, or I like attacking with green creatures. I don't care what the best version is. I want to spend my $10 and enjoy the next hour or two.
Right.
And then there are other people like, you know, Carves, who is a grinder in the truest sense of the word. You know, one of the, you know, I always like, whenever I queue into Carves, I always like, oh, I gotta play tight, because Carves is not going to make a mistake.
Yeah.
And, or, you know, there are lots of people who are like, I sit up a little bit in my chair and I'm like, okay, like, I can't go on autopilot. I gotta really think this through. And, you know, whenever I beat Carves, I always feel great. Not because because when I beat Carves, it feels like I earned it. There are people who I beat where I'm like, no, that's just me getting lucky, or me with the deck, or, you know, I had a great matchup, they did not. But the other thing I always do is, like, I'm always playing Pauper to make decisions and make choices. And I feel like that's why a lot of the decks I play or try to play are a little offbeat, because it forces me to think and kind of forge new paths to be like, well, why am I playing Moan of the Unhallowed? Like, mm-hmm. I know it's a good card. It's only good because it's one card that gets me four tokens and is a mana sink. But again, that is why I think it's well positioned. You know, can everyone who is playing the latest red deck know why it's constructed that way? When I was playing Blitz, like Mono Red Blitz, I didn't like Lightning Bolt. I don't think it's a good card in the deck. I think it's better now, but I'd still rather run, you know, Lava Dart number 5 than Lightning Bolt number 1.
I think it's fun to tweak and see what happens. I always like a stable meta once I've figured out how to beat it.
Sure.
That doesn't seem to be the case anymore, though. It's going to change every 3 months.
I mean, I think that the meta has always been changing. It's just now it changes more quickly.
Yeah.
And I think that has less to do with the cards that are coming in each set and more with the weight of synergy.
Right.
You know, because the Arbor Elf ramp decks existed for a long time. Got the Cascade threats. And then they got the initiative. And now they're real contenders.
So, with regards to your analysis, you talked about how the analysis can show the real story behind who won and who top aided. Can you go into like a high level how that works and how you do your analysis so that people can understand the numbers a little bit better when they see them on the screen?
Yeah, of course. So, currently I use two, well, three kind of main metrics. The first is raw volume, and that's just assigning each deck an archetype and figuring out how many copies were in the top 32. Then, me and an old friend of mine, Jay Siri, who is a pauper grinder, did a lot of work on Stompy and Infect back in the day. Someone I worked a lot on with the old, like, Controltron lists years ago. We came up with a metric called Win Plus, and that's basically taking every deck gets a point for each win X2 or better. So X2 is 1 point, X1 is 2 points, X3 is 3 points. XO, sorry, is 3 points. And that kind of measures a deck in the top 32 against the other decks in the Swiss. And so basically what it means is if you are getting a win plus to volume ratio that approaches one, that means the deck's averaging a top 16 finish somewhere in there. And so if it's like 0.9 or on average, it's like closer to a top 16, maybe top 17, but still in that range. As you go above that ratio of one, so 1.01, 1.02, it's approaching a top 8 finish. The other metric I use is, and that's only for Swiss. That only looks at Swiss results because, oftentimes the difference between ninth place and eighth place are like minuscule percentage points of tiebreaker. And, if the person in 15th place had won one more match or their opponent had won one more match, they would have been in eighth place. So I think it's important to have a metric that just looks at Swiss results. And there's a result, something that I took from Frank Karsten's recent metagame analysis, and it basically takes raw wins less raw losses. So that's top eight inclusive. And that gives you an insight into how decks performed overall, including top eight, because, sometimes it's important to know that the deck that went 6-0 and or 7-0 and then lost in the first round. And then there's a deck that went 5-2 and went all the way. It's important to see those differences.
So
And
you're,
so,
are you, com so let's say we have five burn decks in the top 32, and your win plus is the total wins and the total losses in Swiss. And then the last metric you said is like, let's say two of them made the top eight and went all the way. Then you're taking the Swiss wins and losses and adding the top eight wins to it.
so here, let me actually pull up a sheet from a recent challenge. I'm not going to do this past weekend, which is the 22nd, 23rd, because I haven't entered that sheet yet. But I'm going to look at the challenge that took place on October 16th. So this was an event where there were four blue-black terror decks in the top eight, and one of them won the event. There were eight of these decks in the tournament, or rather in the top 32. And out of all these decks, looks like one, two, three, four of them went X2, and one went 6-1 in the Swiss. So that means there was a total of seven win plus points distributed amongst the eight decks. Take seven divided by eight, you're approaching one. So really looks like probably averaging about a top 16 finish. And that's also because two of them finished outside the top three, like it with X3 records. But, we have a bunch of these in the top eight, four of them in the top eight. Now, two of them met in the finals, the other two went out in the quarterfinals. So when you look at their K wins, all their wins less all their losses in top eight inclusive, that's 24.
And that's
So
including all of the matches that were in the top 32, not just
all of
the four decks that made top eight.
not just the four decks that made top eight.
Okay.
So the 4-3s got one, the 5-2s got three. And so what you're seeing is an average record there, three wins more than losses. So an average of a 5-2 record. And again, that's just for counting the top 32.
And then what does that say about the deck at that point?
Well, one, it definitely was almost certainly the best deck of the weekend. It averaged, a 5-2 record, with seven, with four finishes in the top eight and a win. And but just looking at that in isolation doesn't tell you much unless you look at the other decks. So we can look at the red deck. It had five appearances. It had a better win plus ratio. In five appearances, it had a win plus record of six. So it had 2 6-1s, 2 5-2s, and a 4-3. It had also a K win of 16. So what does that say? Individually, in three fewer appearances, it had a slightly better win plus, so it actually did better in that metric, a slightly better K win ratio, so slightly better in that metric. So which deck was better on the weekend or in this event? You could make an argument either way. Dimir Terror was more popular, had better endgame results. Kadoltha Red might have had fewer entries, but each of those entries did slightly better. And that's why I don't try to talk about specific events as much as seasonal totals, because in these small sample sizes, it can be very hard to really kind of pull anything or extricate anything out of that. But
So, do
just
you have
looking at
like a
this,
running tally of these kinds of metrics as the season goes on that you're looking at?
yes. So I actually break up each season into 4-week chunks, and the 16th weekend actually ended a 4-week chunk of gathering data.
Oh, okay.
And so that's where I'm comfortable saying, Grixis Affinity, Dimir Terror, Caugate, Kadoltha Red, and Gruul Ramp are, and honestly, like different Boros Mardu decks are probably like the top tier or top two tiers, with Grixis, Terror, and Caugate kind of being a tier above. Kadoltha being in kind of its own 1.5 tier, with Gruul and Mardu slash Boros being in the next tier.
It seems like the main portion of the meta, if people ignore affinity, is just terror versus red. But then at the same time, I don't know why I feel that way because obviously Caugate is just a super powerful deck that's still there. So
Caugate is probably the best deck in the format, or
yeah.
was in that 4-week span. Like it, and what I do with all these numbers, the so I also take the total volume of win plus scores and assign each deck a weighted volume. I do that with the Karsten influence scores, and then I take the average of all these scores to kind of get like, here's like what the true volume of the deck should be or could be. So, if you want to look at Caugate, just its raw volume in the metagame, just like pure percentage of top 32s is 15.28% of the total metagame. It's has 18.34% of all the win plus scores. It is the best performing Swiss deck out of all the decks,
Oh, wow.
just by raw win plus score. It has five fewer appearances than Affinity and is almost half a percentage point better just in win plus score. So it has more X2s, more X1s. Its weighted score is 15.26, which out of the big three is the worst. It is not the best top eight deck. It's
Weird.
very good for getting into the top eight, not great at closing the deal. It actually has no wins in this chunk. It has 12 top eights, no wins. Its true volume, or taking the average of all those three, is 16.29, which is third best. But if you told me, hey, Alex, I want to top eight the next Pauper Challenge, I don't care about anything else, I just want to get a top eight, I tell you to run Caugate, because it is the best at doing that. If you want to know what's the best at kind of closing the deal, that is winning, right now, it looks like that is either Affinity or Dimir Terror. Both of those are really good. But frankly, to me, if you're worried about, you know, Swiss results tell you more, because only in part because top eights can sometimes come down to coin flips,
right,
literal coin flips, who goes first, who goes second, or Swiss gives you more information, I tell you to run Coggy.
Oh, wow. Hearing it is much better for me than trying to read it, because every time I try to read how these metrics work, my brain explodes. Honestly, I just my eyes glaze over and I say something. I learned something, I think. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and that's on me for not always going back and trying to explain it. I've been trying to do better with that. Sometimes I forget that, like, every couple months I have a new crop of readers, people who haven't seen this before, and I really gotta slow down, take the time to explain it.
So let's see. I wanted to talk about, so the meta seems like pretty wide right now, although the top is very thin. It's only a couple of decks. Do you see any angles of attack to try to come in from the outside if you're not going to be playing one of these major decks? From my perspective, it's like you have to have a lot of life gain that's very fast, or go wide, or have a lot of edicts. But the thing is, the going wide is quite good against the Terror Angler, because you can chump block all day, etc. And if you can back that up with life gain, then you're going to be able to handle the Kuldotha, it appears. Although, so these go wide creatures are generally not going to be effective enough against a flyer that can suddenly become a 20/20.
Yeah, I think it's about figuring out which removal spell is best that week and then building your deck as appropriate. And I think that the best removal spell right now is probably Chainer's Edict, but not because you ever run Chainer's Edict by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Chainer's Edict is a good removal spell when you can run it with other removal spells that can pick up the pieces, so to speak, you know.
Yeah, clear the way so that you can use your Chainer's Edict effectively. Yeah. Especially because Chainer's Edict is working really well against Guardian of the Guild Pact, but you have to get rid of the 1/1s on the battlefield to make it happen.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, to me, it was always, is it Edict, is it Journey to Nowhere, or is it Lightning Bolt / Flame / / Galvanic Blast / Scred? And I think red removal is at the lowest point right now. I think white removal, as it usually is somewhere in the middle. And I think that black removal is best right now. Now, I've not looked at the last week of results. From what I have seen, just by looking at it and trying to discern what's happened with the parsing, red is much better. And when red is better, that is not good for Chainer's Edict, because Chainer's Edict is slow. Chainer's Edict is a sorcery. What is better? Cards like Lightning Bolt. Cards like Scred. So is red removal the best right now? Is it the time to look at cards like Moment of Craving, which is a very bad removal spell, but it gains you 2 life? You know, is that the thing you should be doing? Should you be looking at cards like, you know, how good is a card like Soul Warden or Essence Warden against the red decks? You know, it's not bad.
It's probably pretty decent if you don't run into a Karklan Shaman.
Yeah. Or, you know, there are other versions of that card as well that don't suffer as much. How good is Aven Rift Watcher right now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably halfway decent if you are running that kind of card.
I've seen a very large uptick in Black-White Pestilence at the beginning of the week this week.
Yep, Pestilence is such an interesting card because it is slow, but if you can resolve it, you almost always win the game.
Right.
If you can. But I think part of the issue is, what are the creatures that are 1, 2, and 3 mana that create a life swing? Is it Aven Rift Watcher? Because I'm a big fan of Vampire Sovereign, but I'm not trying to play that card fairly. I'm trying to play it unfairly.
Mm-hmm. I think that right now, The reason that this red deck is so good is because, like we talked about before, Hydro Blast is not good against it. And something like a creature that can block and gains life is better than Hydro Blast in that situation.
Yes.
We get into a position where if everyone's doing that, then you can just flip straight over to Mono Red Blitz and then go right past people because they don't have Hydro Blast on their board anymore.
Yes. I think that also Hydro Blast is one of those things where Hydro Blast is good at trading one for one,
Right.
and Kuldotha Red is not a one for one deck. It is not a traditional red deck. It is a, I mean, it's weird, but it's basically an aggressive Delver deck, is a way to think about it. It's
Okay.
just red. It
Yeah.
has card draw, it has quick threats, it has filtering, it has closing speed. It's kind of a Delver deck that's just red.
Pretty weird. I think the color pie is all different than I was expecting a while ago.
I mean, that is another deck that, like, again, Weight of Synergy, Blood Tokens with Metalcraft, with Kuldotha Rebirth, with Chromatic Star.
Really interesting. So, you've been playing Green Black Arbor Elf Ramp. And you said that your favorite deck of all time is just green black. Have you played any of the mono, or your favorite deck is mono black control? Have you played the new mono black control that people have been running
I
at
have
all?
not. I it's one of those that like is always on my short list to queue up. It's just
Doesn't look like it'd be fun.
no, it's not that. It's that I just haven't had the time to literally sit down and queue that deck up. I was really enamored with the ramp deck. So I played that a lot, a lot, a lot. And theory crafting recently got me thinking about material and all the green and black cards that make tokens, and whether or not you can leverage this with guild. Oh God, whatever that thing is, it's the oof that you can sacrifice tokens, but there's also the Swarm Keeper,
Glitter Barn?
Glimmer. Yes, but
Glimmer
there's
Barn?
also this. Yeah, there's the Swarm Keeper from
I played
Baldur's
it.
Gate that gets bigger, that gets a plus one to counter for each time you create a token.
I played against the person playing blue green Glimmer Barn Swarm Keeper tokens with the
Wave Sifter.
crab inspector, basically. They make a crab and a token and just like wave sifter and stuff like that. It was surprisingly brutal. Like
Well,
spell pierce.
I'm interested in Bloodbriar, which can get very big.
Yeah.
When you sacrifice permanents, which tokens are, and then definitely is interesting to me. Like, there's who is it? There's an old brewer, AOKIS, who
Yeah.
always would run these very convoluted Pox-like builds. And I was always fascinated with them. And, back when Cleansing Wildfire and Indestructible Artifact lands were new, I tried a build with it. And it was, interesting and somewhat good. And I put it down because cannot beat Affinity.
Right. But now Affinity is less represented in League, so maybe you can just whiff on pairing.
Or just run Fangren Marauder and hope.
Right, Fangren Marauder is very good. Speaking of Fangren Marauder, I've been playing a lot of Drawn Eggs, which I see as a off-meta, actually well-positioned deck because you have Tron mana to go over the top of Cogate. You have the go wide in the Edicts. Versus Blue Black Terror, just like you said. Just Chainer's Edict has been so good there. And then I've also just been like playing so many life gain spells, but I was trying to play Fangren Marauder and it was just too slow against them. So now I'm on four Weather the Storm. And that's been decent enough at, bridging the gap to getting into the Fangon Marauder, because once you get that out, it's good. But even Affinity, sometimes you play out the Fangon Marauder, and then they just go munitions for one Galvanic Blast and then move on with my life. You're like, well, I'm 6 mana.
Yeah, well, when you cast off a two lands, it's not as bad. But yes, I totally
True, true,
understand where you're
true.
coming from.
Yeah. I worked really hard for that one.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Do you think that you like to play when you hop into a queue, are you playing for fun and for brewing, or are you researching? What is your goal? Are you just playing because you enjoy it?
It's a little bit of everything. It depends on what's going on that week. I have, a young child at home, so usually when I am playing, it's even if I'm playing an off-meta brew, it's for research. Like, what's going on? How does this deck work? Or it's running into the, oh, I get to play Talarian Terror against Talarian Terror like 5 times this week. That's awesome because I want to just do a quick guide on like that deck. Or something like so. There's never a time I'm playing Pauper, really, just to play Magic. It's usually related to content and trying something new or trying to figure something out or doing research for a patron post or something. Which is fine. Like I still enjoy it. It's still Magic. It's still fun. But Pauper is really more of like okay, like I'm doing this and it's fun, but if I'm like looking to do something that's really just don't care, just want to have some fun, I usually will like look for a cube that's on Arena or Magic Online or, draft on Arena.
Some free drafting.
Yeah, I put a little bit of money into Arena every so often, but I haven't in about a year.
That's good. That's the goal. Ever since I started playing Limited, I was always like, maybe I can go infinite. And finally, I just started playing Constructed, and that's actually where the cash is.
Yes.
That's funny. Not everybody has to be trying to win everything, and it's cool to see the ideas that you're coming up with, and see that people are kind of approaching the same kind of concepts on from different angles.
Yeah, I think that, especially because there is not, any kind of huge prize for being with Pauper, that is like, yes, you can grind and win the trophies and, convert that into a like money in some capacity, or you can use it to qualify for the mocks. The vast majority, the stakes are low. And so it provides this opportunity to be like, well, would this work? Every so often I'm like, I really am trying to make Marine X proliferate work, like hardened scales, like it's exponential. There are so many creatures that come into play with a 1/1 counter, and there are all these cheap proliferate cards. Like, can it work? I've gotten close, and maybe just a few more sets need to be released before Travel Preparations becomes a really, really good card. I've tried to make blue white like auras work with Fencing Ace because Fencing Ace, if you can slap an ethereal armor on that, that does a lot of damage, but not quite there. Doesn't do enough. Doesn't mean the deck couldn't be good, but do you really want a blue splash in your heroic deck, so to speak? But I'm willing to, take those losses in the end to try something different. Like the number of tickets I spewed trying to make Jund lands work si 6 years ago, I got it to work a little bit. I and every so often I'm like, I'm gonna cast Mulch and Winding Way for lands and strip your hand with Raven's Crime and Last Rites and lose because this deck has no closing power. But it's still
Wow.
enjoyable.
Well, actually, once when people were experimenting with Basilisk Gate, 420 Dragon and Zune were just and Simplify were just iterating and iterating and iterating on lands. They were just playing eight mulch, and just trying to make lands work. Seemed pretty interesting. Maybe now's the time.
I think the way to actually make lands work is 8 mulch, yes, but it's a makeshift munitions deck with heap gate.
Okay.
Like that's it. It you just get as many heap gates into play as you can, and you just make treasure, and you fling them at your opponent's head, and it's a slow deck that does almost nothing, but doesn't matter. Like you're gonna fling treasure at your opponent's head until they're dead, and you use makeshift munitions as board control. You know, you can stitch it together with Killing Tree Folk, which is, you know, I'm gonna cycle my lands and pick up my lands and cycle my lands to draw some cards. And then you can, you know, use other ways of regrowing permanents to try and keep your makeshift munitions around. And you have Moments Peace to stay alive and Weather the Storm to stay alive. And
So
you're
it's
gonna
like
make a lot
a
of.
some sort of wonky lands turbo fog deck.
Yeah, it's not good. I don't think it is. And I haven't figured out a way to crack it, but it's one of those that's on the back burner because, again, if you can generate all this extra material, why not? And if you're making treasure, you can cast all sorts of ridiculous things.
True. That sounds like fun. I think one of my
Let's.
favorite things to do is just try to find something that shouldn't work that all of a sudden does. So I like experimenting and seeing all these different angles of attack. I like that. So moving to our final segments here, I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about your favorite card of all time.
I mean,
Is it just Chittering Rats?
like if I had to pick a card that I love more than any other card, I love Tortured Existence. I love moving cards from zone to zone. I have Tortured Existence in a few commander decks. I love exchanging resources. I think it's really nifty. I mean, if you really want to talk to me about like what my favorite thing to do in No, Commander, which is a format I also play a lot of and mostly for fun. I love cards that bring themselves back from the graveyard. Like if you can just let me cast Reassembling Skeleton or bring it back from the graveyard and sacrifice it for value, I'll be a very, very happy person.
Nice.
But, you know, Tortured Existence, everything in that vein, like Carrion Feeder, the Tortured Existence deck is one of my favorite decks of all time. And it is not good right now. It lacks the engine necessary to really a secondary engine necessary to really kind of turn the corner in the current format. I love that card. I, you know, Mike Linneman, who's, you know, the art guy, like once slid me a DM and was like, the art's up for sale. And I'm like, there's no way I'm gonna be able to justify spending that much money on art that is that. Because there's no way I'm hanging in my house, and also that's way more money than I feel comfortable spending on a piece of art. But I love that art. I love the card, and I would love to see more engines like that, like these slow, ponderous engines that you have to build around instead of ones that kind of
Just show their face, and this is exactly how you use it. I wonder
that
if
comes to
there's a
you.
Gates Tortured Existence deck that it wouldn't exist. It would probably be okay.
Oh God, I definitely saw one on Twitter today. I want to say it was Adepto.
Oh yeah, of course. He's done that a couple of times.
Like it's an Esper Gates Tortured Existence deck, and I'm like, what is going on here?
Sacred Cat. It's the thing.
But no, it's there's a lot going on. I pulled it up. There's Rafine's Informant. There's Mull Drifter. There's Monk Idealist. There's a lot. I actually think Rafine's Informant is a very good card these days. But
Right. It's very
yeah,
powerful.
it's a gate deck. There's a Basilisk Gate, but there's no Guardian of the Guild Pact. There's four Golgari Brownscales, but no Stinkweed Imp, there's Four Tortured Existence, and a way to get it. It's a very interesting deck, and it's definitely a way I would take Tortured Existence these days, although I probably wouldn't run Inspiring Overseer over the dog.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, gaining
just
life is
two
good.
Is so much better than three.
Right. Yeah. And you can get it with enchantment things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would be a cool avenue to explore moving forward. Maybe we'll see a tortured five-color Tortured Existence Gates deck in the next Channel Fireball article.
Probably not. That sounds like something I need to test a bunch before I actually ever, you know, submit it.
Everyone wants to see five-color piles. Well, we're going to start wrapping it up. Is there anybody that you'd like to give a shout-out or anything you'd like to plug? I know you have a blog, a Patreon.
Yeah, so like I said, you can find me on Twitter at NerdToTheCore. That is the best place to find me and basically everything that I do.
And then from there, you can get to the blog and everything?
Yeah. So from there, you can get to my link tree, which has links to everything. So I have a Patreon, patreon.com/nerdtothecore. There's the blog, nerdtothecore.com. And I also am a writer for Channel Fireball. And all that stuff is linked through my blog and Patreon. If you like my work, just give me a shout out. Let people know. Really appreciate it. Love interacting with people on Twitter. And hopefully at real life events at some point in the future.
Yeah, the next Popper GP.
The first Popper GP, but we'll get there soon.
I hope so.
Hopefully.
Has it been rewarding seeing the format grow through these years from basically the founding of it and being part of it?
I'm always happy to see more people playing Popper. I think the thing that, you know, that I'd love to see more is I miss the days when both challenges were regularly seven rounds. Like, I consider that to be like the sign of health.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the Saturday challenge continues to be six rounds instead of seven, and the Sunday challenge continues to be seven rounds, tells me there's more opportunity for more international growth, since, you know, the Saturday challenge tends to be less America focused because of when it starts in the States.
Right.
But I'd really like to see both those challenges get to like seven rounds on the regular as opposed to six and seven.
I think some of the people in Europe would like to have it continue to be six rounds so that they can continue to get good EV.
I understand.
But it would be really cool to see the format grow. We had a little bit of a time where it was like 700 players again, and now it's around 500, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's something that really, you know, the leagues are such a different behemoth than the challenges because you can queue in and queue in and queue in, and it's not like you can play a little bit more for fun instead of trying to, like, if you scrub out of a challenge, that's a significant chunk. But if, you know, it's cheaper to play a league than it is to go to a movie.
Right. True. But it takes more time.
Yes. Sometimes, unless you're playing red.
Right. So pick your battles. Well, I appreciate everything that you've done for the format.
And thank you.
As we said, you're on the Popper format panel and you've got a lot of history and you have a lot of analysis. So we can expect that things continue to go well and hopefully nothing breaks. And if it does break the format soon, I hope it's a combo card just for my own personal fun. Thanks again, Alex.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.